What a piece of luck. We start our election campaign today.
Elections? In this place?
Of course, we make our choice every 12 months. Every citizen has a choice. Are you going to run?
Like blazes, the first chance I get.
Okay, so it's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. In the second hour this week, China has killed 20 Indian soldiers at a remote mountain border in the Himalayas. And North Korea blows up a liaison centre with South Korea. So just who is sending a signal to who there? Also, the Lockerbie bombing. David Pidstock worked on Channel 4's Maltese Double Cross documentary with Alan Frankovich that pointed to Libya definitely not being behind it. It being some squabbling and infighting going on within the Western intelligence services. And he also explains the bizarre Lockerbie 9/11 connection. And the latest instalment of the sordid tale of King George VI and Winston Churchill's alleged collaboration with Hitler's private secretary and leader of the Nazi party at the end of the war. Martin Bormann disappeared at the end of World War II and was sentenced at Nuremberg in absentia to the death penalty. The prize, though, for Winston Churchill, George VI and anyone that helped Bormann escape at the end of the war was their share in $1 billion or so US dollars worth of Nazi loot. The biggest cover-up, is it, of the 20th century? Uncovered here, lie by lie. This week, two more layers of the Bormann cover-up stripped away. The author of Aftermath, Martin Bormann and the Fourth Reich, Ladislas Farrago's publisher, old-school New York Times investigative journalist and former head of the New York Times book publishing arm, Thomas Lipscomb, gives us his long view after 50 years of investigative journalism on whether or not Bormann survived. And you can guess what he found out. Plus, Frank Brandenburg's 1990 book, Quest, interviews with 11 former SS Nazis, the majority of them, confirming that Bormann did survive the war, with most of the rest blowing their top when the question was even asked. In the 1980s, two of these former, or was it current, SS men claimed to have personally met Bormann after the war, and one, Medyard Klapper, said, who's now running a gun shop, or then running a gun shop in Karlsruhe, he said he met him as recently as 1982. Also, what were the secret codes? Herr Brandenburg reveals them to let you into the Fourth Reich plotters' confidence. That's all in the second hour after six. But joining me to review this week's news is Martin Summers, Irish Republican Labour activist. Hi, Martin. I thought we'd start this week by looking at some of the incredible, well, I would say it's incredible, news about banning of things like comic films, things like Fawlty Towers, the episode to do with Don't Mention the Germans, another one to do with the Jamaican football team. Now, apparently they may now have been restored. But what do you make of this? It's almost like a sort of cultural revolution is going on where certain things that were said 30, 40 years ago have now got to be erased from history, even if they were just comedy.
Well, I think you've got to judge every individual case on its merits. As John Cleese pointed out in relation to that particular episode of Fawlty Towers, the major bloviating on about the West Indian cricket team was not... the show was not patting him on the back for being a racist. It was basically mocking him for being a racist. And of course, it's very hard to judge when people are. I mean, basically, that was basically taking the mick out of upper class racism. So the idea that this was somehow offensive rather missed the point. And of course, in actual practice, they've decided that they're not going to cover it.
Yeah, so, I mean, in a way, as a writer, if you can't send up a racist, what's the point of picking up a pen?
Well, I think that's right. But on the other hand, there are other things I've been looked at. So, for example, in Bristol this week, both St. Mary Redcliffe and the Cathedral have decided that they're going to remove the stained glass windows which celebrate Edward Colston.
That, of course, is very, very different, isn't it? You've got something which is commemorating slavery and the slave trade and a particular individual. It's very different when you start... I mean, say, for example, Till Death Us Do Part, that series, which you may remember, I thought that was quite cleverly crafted to draw in a racist audience to almost... to think, oh, well, here's Alf Garnett, he's saying what we say. But actually, what the series did is it sent up Alf Garnett, didn't it? He was certainly not portrayed as a particularly bright character. Most of the time he came a cropper, and he was really the victim of the programme rather than its star.
Well, unfortunately, as the guy who wrote it, whose name I've forgotten now, said, he didn't realise that he was going to get an audience of people who actually identified with Alf Garnett. And there's no, you know, you can't fix stupid. And, you know, people are going to take things in any way they want to take them, aren't they? And a rather sad thing this week was the destruction of Scipio Africanus's gravestone in Henbury Churchyard, who was a slave who died in 1720 and was buried there. And there was a kind of a rather famous gravestone commemorating him. And somebody has gone in there and smashed it up and left a note saying that, you know, this is... in revenge for the removal of Colston's statue. I think what we can say is that what's happening is there's a lot of re-examination of things which have been swept under the carpet, some of which has gone, you know, people are basically like getting rid of a Fawlty Towers episode patently wrong, others less so, like the removal of Colston's statue. And then you've also got, you know, people basically vandalising what are historical records and relics in a rather unpleasant fashion. And, you know, this is how society conducts these kind of debates, isn't it?
Well, I suppose so. But then there's also the possibility, particularly, I mean, for example, things said on Twitter, an anonymous daubing of something in the middle of the night. There could be something else behind it. It's not even necessarily somebody that is a big fan of Edward Colston. It may be somebody who's just literally trying to, you know, push a narrative, push a debate, get people what we call hardening the sides, isn't it? Get people sort of having to decide which side they're on.
Well, yes, and as we know in the past with things like the strategy of tension in Italy in the 1970s and so on, the people who do something might not necessarily be the people who are actually responsible. So the bombings in Piazza Fontana were blamed on the anarchists, but it ultimately came out it wasn't the anarchists who'd done it, it was the secret services. And, of course, that kind of manipulation of public opinion is very you know, you've got to be very, very on your guard to recognise what's going on.
The mayor apparently this week, Marvin Rees, who's mixed race, he's been sent some racist letters, again anonymously. It's very difficult to know who's behind it. It could be the far right, but then it could be other elements just simply trying to I suppose move this story on, move it into new directions, amplify this Colston message.
Well, I think what has happened is clearly the far right have been extremely exercised by what's happened, and they've worked themselves up into a bit of a frenzy about it, as we saw last weekend in London. But, of course, in the US itself, there's a very closely fought presidential election, and all sides are manipulating the narrative to try and get their people elected. And, you know, you've got to take everything that everybody says with a great big pinch of salt.
Well, I mean, both of them are appalling candidates for this presidential election in the United States. Don't you think maybe if Black Lives Matter put forward as someone who is a bit of more of a kind of grassroots campaigner, maybe not necessarily even black themselves, but certainly someone who's done a lot to further civil rights in the United States, they might actually stand quite a good chance now, given the profile that Black Lives Matter has got, in beating both Biden and Trump?
Well, the problem with that is that it's a first-past-the-post rigged system, and nobody can win the presidential election now other than Biden or Trump. That's it. Because the whole thing's a stitch up. So if you ran somebody against Biden, all that would happen is you'd hand it to Trump. So that, therefore, there will be other candidates, There are always other candidates on the ballot, possibly from the Green Party, but they won't get very far because of the first past the post setup and the Electoral College. So, that, you know, and the Black Lives Matter, in any case, is a very amorphous movement. It's got lots of grassroots support, you know, like kids just emailing each other and WhatsApping and so on. But it's also got loads of ostentatious corporate support. So all these various corporations are rushing forward to say that they think that Black Lives Matter and that they identify with the cause and so on. And of course, the suspicion there is that they're basically backing Biden, and that's what that's and they don't want Trump, and that's what this is all about.
It's certainly interesting looking at the Edward Colston statue as a kind of sideshow to the US presidential election. You know, you may be right about that, but I don't agree with you that another candidate couldn't challenge Biden or Trump, because I think there's most people are just simply in the states of voting for the lesser of two evils. If Black Lives Matter were to endorse somebody as another candidate, and a lot of other alternative radical civil rights groups, etc., are behind them, the one thing that I would say would mean they won't get elected president is if they don't get media exposure, because this is one of the things that seems to be absolutely key in actually winning one of these modern presidential elections, is how you come across in the media.
Well, in that case you've got to have loads of money. I mean, it's quite clear that you've got to have millions of dollars to even think of running for president. If you've got to have it yourself, you've got to have them yourself, or you've got to have other people to you know, to provide the funds. And the Black Lives Matter hasn't got a structure where it could agree an agreed candidate. It's basically a grassroots movement with a sort of corporate wing tacked on, which has got quite a lot of funding. But the obvious person to run would be somebody like Tulsi Gabbard or Bernie Sanders to run as a third party candidate. They've already got media recognition and so on, but both of them have decided to back Biden because they don't want to help Trump, and that's the reality of where we're at.
It's so horrendous, isn't it? What a horrible system. You can't really call it democracy at all. Anyway, Martin, I don't know if you watched any of it, but it's been on the BBC this week. It's called The Salisbury Poisonings, a drama about what really happened down in Salisbury 2 years ago. Did you watch any of it?
I've been reading Craig Murray's rather useful debunking of it.
Well, I watched about 10 seconds, well, not 10 seconds, maybe 20, 30 seconds of it. It was like watching paint dry, but I thought it's quite useful maybe to share what your thoughts are on some of the major holes in this, because it seems to me that nowadays we're looking at, say, for example, with the Flight 93 film after 9/11, when one of these big events takes place, the idea is that there is an official narrative of what really happened, which doesn't really make any sense. But in order to try and make sense of it, there is then a drama and a film made to say, oh, well, this is what really happened. Now, obviously, there are a lot of problems with what really did happen in Salisbury and a lot of things that don't add up at all. So what would you like to point to as regards the Skripal poisonings that, you know, that doesn't seem to make any sense about it?
Well, the first thing to point out is that if you really intended to prosecute somebody for doing this, and they've named certain Russians that they claim are responsible, then you don't make a film like this accusing them of being guilty in the first place, because then they wouldn't get a fair trial if they ever came to trial. So it's quite clear they've no intention of having any kind of trial about any of this. So this is why the BBC, who are basically playing their role here as state broadcaster of Britain, they've basically got a military advisors for this programme. So the intelligence services and the military are advising them on what should go in the programme. So let's get absolutely clear about what this programme is. It is grade A propaganda. And the other thing, is, of course, is that the basic things that are wrong about this, that one of the things that Craig Murray pointed out was in the very first episode, they were saying that although there was Novichok everywhere all over the place, nobody died because it was too cold, and therefore in other words, they're coming up with explanations of what happened, which we didn't even hear at the time. And basically, it's shoddy propaganda. That's what it is.
Isn't it? And one of the problems is if you develop a complicated lie, like it does appear the whole episode in Salisbury is, it's very difficult to get everyone to agree to the same lie. Someone will think, you know, it might start accidentally introducing the truth into the narrative and then making it so it doesn't work. But anyway, this week I spoke to Steve Brody about Porton Down, which is just down the road from Salisbury, because we know many times in the past they've lied. We also know that they've had to pay out millions of pounds in compensation to people they lied to. So I thought it'd be interesting to have a chat to him about his at time during the noughties, mainly exposing the lies that have been told by Porton Down, which of course was just only about 10 minutes, 15 minutes drive down the road from Salisbury, the British chemical and biological weapons plant that under international treaties shouldn't even exist. One of the terms which Steve uses in the interview is the Porton Down gas chamber. So they were poisoning people in that gas chamber and killing too.
They were basically carrying out all sorts of unethical experiments, were they not, in the 1950s on National Service personnel who were told that they were going to be, you know, let off normal duties provided they went to Porton Down to research into the common cold.
Well, one of the interesting things Steve told me, which is not on the interview, is that the I said to him, well, what about Fort Detrick in the United States? And he said, well, actually, the Americans were quite a few years behind us. And then he added, and we were quite a few years behind the Germans, because much of the sarin nerve gas, this particularly nasty stuff, was actually developed in Nazi Germany and brought over to Porton Down at the end of the Second World War.
Yeah, so in other words, a lot of the same thing happened with the Japanese experiments that the Kempeitai carried out in China. They were given all sorts of basically protection, so that provided they passed on all of the research that they'd been doing into chemical and biological weapons. And as we know, chemical and biological warfare, it is banned, and there's supposed to be a ban against it.
What is Porton Down doing as a weapons, chemical and biological weapons plant when such plants are not supposed to exist, Martin?
Well, the justification in the West is that somebody at some point might develop a chemical and biological warfare capacity, so we've got to carry on researching it to find out whether they are. And it was massively ramped up after 9/11 as a result of the anthrax attacks, if people remember those, which kills six people, I believe, and potentially kills lots more. But, of course, it then transpired that the anthrax, which was supposedly sent by Islamist militants, turned out to come from Fort Detrick itself. And then there was a big investigation of one individual who was blamed for it, who clearly wasn't responsible. And it was part of the process. The people who were sent these anthrax letters were the Congress people who were likely to vote against the Patriot Act. So it was clearly a provocation from within the US security forces. There's a whole load of questions underlying all of this. And of course, I sent you stuff from James Bamford yesterday about, because he's collated all of the evidence that suggests that this COVID-19 may be a biological weapon, but not a Chinese biological weapon, a Western biological weapon of the kind that they've used in North Korea and in Cuba previously.
I've also got a couple of, I think, interesting articles, one by an Israeli intelligence officer and another one anonymously giving, I think it's the Saker, it was when on the Saker blog, which give a completely different story of what happened in Salisbury. Anyway, I'm hoping we're able to hear Steve Brody now, so let's have a listen to him.
My name is Steve Brody. I was the Home Affairs correspondent for BBC Television News in the West Country for nearly 30 years. Before that, I was a newspaper reporter. And then I moved into local radio. I was one of the members that launched the GWR franchise in the West, and I was deputy head of news there. And then I moved on to the launch of BBC Wiltshire Sound in Swindon, where I was the news editor. And indeed, I'm still working as a freelance, despite having retired full-time working from the BBC.
You have investigated Porton Down, particularly deaths of servicemen there. Can you tell me how the investigation started when you first came across the story?
Absolutely. I was driving home along the M4 in the summer of 1999, and phone went, and chap, police contact. And he said, would I be interested in an investigation into what he said was the goings-on at Porton Down? Well, I thought for about a millisecond and said, yes, I would. I'd be very interested indeed. And that led to one of the most extraordinary investigations I've ever been involved in. I was particularly proud that I broke the story on television, particularly proud about that. It turned out that the kernel of the whole thing was the fact that a young man who's only 20 years old had died in the gas chamber at Porton Down in 1953. He had gone there because he had been told he would get an additional 4 shillings and 6 pence a week if he took part in a programme to find a cure for the common cold. Complete nonsense. It wasn't a cure for the common cold. It was an experiment with sarin nerve gas on young servicemen volunteers who were asked to go to Porton Down, and he died. And that was the beginning of an extraordinary investigation which involving the police force, the MOD, the government, and sundry other people from the secret services.
So I understand it was a secret inquest originally.
Yes.
Of this man. His name, Ronald Madison, I believe.
His name was Ronald Madison. He was a 20-year-old airman in 1953 doing his national service. And why was he at Porton Down? Well, in the last months of the Second World War, Tony, as the Allies advanced through Germany, the British Army came upon stockpiles of nerve gas. Within 2 weeks of the Army unit that discovered this stockpile of nerve gas, experiments were being run at Porton Down in Wiltshire, the chemical and biological warfare research establishment, highly secret. But it's quite astonishing. The war was still going on, and volunteers were being asked to go to Porton Down and were being tested by the nerve gas which had been discovered, stockpiled in Germany. And those experiments didn't stop at the end of the war. The Cold War came along, and the establishment, as it were, wanted to see how people would survive alleged nerve gas attacks. And Ronald Madison went to Porton Down. One morning in May, he went into the gas chamber there, and he had a patch of army uniform taped to his arm. This patch was taped to his arm, and onto that patch was dropped in a liquid form 200 millilitres of sarin nerve gas, one of the most desperately lethal gases known to man, 26 times more lethal than cyanide. Within 23 minutes, he had died from the most terrible reaction to the poison, rushed to the hospital in Porton Down, and died. Quite a terrible thing. It is a scandal that it happened. There's absolutely no doubt about that.
Let's just be clear here. Is this a liquid or a gas?
It was in liquid form. It can be in different forms. Sarin nerve gas can be delivered in different forms. And they were experimenting. The scientists at Porton were experimenting to see, basically, how much it takes to kill somebody. And Ronald Madison died.
So he was a human guinea pig. I mean, this reminds us almost of the sorts of Nazi experiments on people.
Oh, completely. In fact, that's one of the comments that has been made in the last 60 or 70 years, that these experiments mirrored what was happening in Nazi Germany. Truly appalling, and we all obviously think that's terrible. But in fact, similar experiments were happening here in the UK.
Okay, so what about the investigations? An internal one at Porton Down, a coroner's inquest, and police?
Well, what happened, in May of 1953, he died, and there was an inquest, and it was held in Salisbury, which is quite ironic, given the goings-on recently involving Novichok. And there was an inquest, before a coroner in the city of Salisbury in Wiltshire, behind closed doors. Behind closed doors. Nobody admitted.
Is it something like a military tribunal type thing?
Not really, no, no. It was
why
a pro-
should it, how can you have an inquest behind closed
Well, the culture is different then, Tony. Remember, this is 1953. Allegedly, the Soviets were knocking on the door. And the government, that's their argument in any case, and it was from a secret establishment. So the inquest was held, and the coroner returned a verdict of misadventure. His parents, Ronald Manson's parents, were never told the truth, never told the outcome of the inquest. Meanwhile, another investigation was going on at Porton Down by the scientists who had in fact carried out the experiments in the first place. And they concluded that he died from nerve gas, from sarin nerve gas. They didn't mess about. They knew what killed him. That, too, was in secret, and that, too, was never revealed for another 50 years.
What about the police? Did they get involved?
The police did not do an investigation into the death of Ronald Manson, because it happened on a government establishment, and the verdict delivered by the coroner was misadventure. So there was no need to do an investigation. So Wiltshire Police, in 1953, did not investigate what happened to Ronald Manson.
Were there any others that managed to survive these tests?
Well, of course, actually, Ronald Manson was desperately unlucky. He was duped into going there, for a start. At the time, throughout the UK, in barrack rooms and on ships and airfields, posters were going up, and or actually orders, standing orders, which is a very legal difference between that. It's lawyers could argue about that all day, and indeed did, saying, go for a week at Porton Down, help find a cure for the common cold. And hundreds of young servicemen did indeed go to Porton Down over the 1950s, 60s, 70s, and actually into the 80s. And this went on, and it would have continued to go on, apart from a man called Gordon Bell. He was another young serviceman who had three experiments on him at Porton Down, and he survived. But he turned into a whistleblower, one of the great whistleblowers. Not particularly well known, but within the circles of this particular incident, very well known. He, in 1999, went to Wiltshire Police. He actually was living in Canada, and he came over from Canada, and he went to see Wiltshire Police and made his claims about the fact that these experiments had been taking place on young men without their knowledge. Duped, in other words. And indeed, to their credit, Wiltshire Police thought, well, yeah, well, this needs looking into. And what happened was that a head of CID then, a policeman called Detective Superintendent Jerry Luckett, he filmed a team of officers to investigate this. He persuaded the Crown Prosecution Service that this was worth doing. And they sort of said, OK, all right. So off they went. And the background to this is quite astonishing. These Wiltshire detectives went to America. They went to the Pentagon. They actually went to the Pentagon and were shown top-secret files about what the Americans were doing with sarin nerve gas, because they got the samples from the Brits. And indeed, they were given access. They talked to people. They took the files away. Quite extraordinary. And came back. So we've got the police doing this investigation into a criminal offence. A criminal offence. On the other hand, you know, why had it gone on? Who had authorised this? And what happened was that the police said in August 1999, and I was part of it, because I was part of the investigation, which was very rare to be asked to be part of an investigation of this level. Clearly, I didn't go to the Pentagon, but I was being informed of this throughout this extraordinary investigation. And In August 1999, Wiltshire Police announced that they would be investigating the death of Ronald Madison some 50-odd years after his death. And that the MOD, or in essence Porton Down, would be facing charges of assault and corporate manslaughter. Cue, Tony, uproar.
Now, for those that survived these experiments, did they describe what it was like to be poisoned by
moment
sarin?
The BBC revealed that this was happening, and as I say, cue uproar, every journalist in the country was running around frantically trying to find out what was going on in Porton Down. We, at the BBC, were bombarded with letters, hundreds of letters, it's quite extraordinary, hundreds of letters from colonels, from majors, from privates, basically all ranks in the armed forces contacted the BBC and said, oh, hold on, I took part in that. And one of the great lines which was often repeated in these letters from young soldiers, young airmen, young sailors, saying, they asked their NCOs, you know, should I volunteer for this thing at Porton Down? And this was often repeated. Senior NCO said, actually, young man, never volunteer for anything in the army, and particularly do not volunteer for anything at Porton Down. A giveaway line, a light-hearted line, but absolutely true. Absolutely true. I travel the country talking to people about their experiences, and particularly Gordon Bell, the whistleblower, who had cancers. A lot of these people, Tony, a lot of these people who I spoke to have certainly since died, and many were ill at the time, with allegedly unrelated illnesses from the experiments at Porton Down. Hundreds.
So did they ever describe what it was like to be given sarin nerve gas?
Oh, yes.
To survive?
Well, they were ill. The dose, obviously, was way too high. That was the thing. It was delivered in 20 drops onto this patch on his forearm.
I understand it gave you sort of tunnel vision.
Oh.
They're breathing.
It's a respiratory illness.
One person described it was like breathing through a tiny straw.
Yes.
So it was very difficult to breathe.
It is. You die slowly. Well, it took Ronald Madison 23 minutes to die, but if you're conscious of that, it's a thoroughly, thoroughly unpleasant experience. And, of course, it was meant to be. It was to wipe out lots of people.
So this investigation by the BBC and by the police, how did Porton Down take that?
No comment. Yes, that was the bottom line. And it's very interesting, when it started, Jerry Luckett, said to me, this will be a lengthy investigation. And he was right. 4 years later, they were still doing it. So we'd moved on into the new decade. And I have to remind myself, actually, a year or two later, it was quite interesting. Eventually, the government gave Wiltshire Police a £900,000 grant, which was quite a lot of money in 2001, to carry out the investigation, to continue to carry out the investigation. Very unusual. And so the investigation went on. Detectives, rather like me, but in probably much better style, travelled up and down the country, meeting these people and gathering evidence. And eventually, a year after that, the Crown Prosecution Service took a very controversial decision. The Crown Prosecution Service decided that there was not enough evidence for a criminal investigation. The Porton Down Veterans Association, these men were no longer young men, they were in their 50s and 60s and 70s. Took that very badly indeed. Very badly indeed. And one of the excuses was from the Crown Prosecution Service was that all the scientists who had taken part in these experiments in the 50s and 60s and 70s had died. So therefore there couldn't be a criminal investigation. I have to say, I thought that was a poor, very poor decision. One wonders whether it was a political decision, but of course there is no evidence to say that. There is no evidence whatsoever to say that. And it would be wrong to say it, because certainly the BBC tried to look, and I looked, and we couldn't find any evidence of that. But that was the bottom line, no criminal investigation.
So it did come to court, though, didn't it, in the High Court in 2002?
It did. In 2002, David Masters, the then coroner for Wiltshire, an excellent guy, very unusual to find a coroner like David Masters, he took the whole thing very seriously. And he applied to the Crown Court, he applied to the High Court for permission to quash the verdict of the 1953 inquest in Salisbury. He applied to the High Court for permission to quash the verdict and to reopen the inquest. It's one, if not the greatest distance between inquests being finished and then reopened in British legal history. One of them. There's bound to be one somewhere else, which I don't know about. So we all went off to the High Court in front of the then Lord Chief Justice, Lord Wolfe. And I don't know if you've been to the High Court, but menial hacks and journalists sit right at the bottom in the front row, and the Lord Chief Justice is up there. It is a Dickensian court. They're all being modernised now, but it was in those days, it was a Dickensian court. And in sweeps Lord Justice Wolfe. Place was packed, absolutely packed with veterans, families, Ronald Madison surviving family, and journalists. I was quite surprised. He took very little time sweeping aside any arguments why he should not quash the verdict, and said, yes, I'm quashing it, and the coroner and Evans and Wiltshire Police can continue their investigation. Thank you and good night, and swept out. And there was a rather bizarre incident in the middle of this desperately, desperately serious investigation. It was right at the core of how we govern in this country. Jerry Luckett said to me, Steve, said, come to the back of the court, I'd like you to meet some people. So we trolled off. I thought, must be a good witness or another victim. Excellent, that's what journalists want. They want to talk to people who are there and all the rest of it. So we went to the back of court number 3 in the High Court, and there were two pretty serious-looking gents in smart suits who weren't looking very pleased. And Jerry Luckett went up to these two chaps. He said, Ma, I'd like to introduce Steve Brodie from the BBC. Steve Brodie, meet MI5. Something out of the Corrin novel or Spooks. And we all said hello, and there were a bit of an uncomfortable shuffling of feet, and that was it.
So they'd lost?
Oh, yes. They'd lost.
So this then preceded the inquest.
Well, what happened was, the coroner said to the police force, gather me evidence, and I'm going to open an inquest. It took another year before it... This went on for such a long time, to 2004. For the inquest to be set up, the terms of the inquest, where it was going to be held, and eventually they decided on, of all places, Trowbridge. It's quite weird.
Well, that's probably one of the nearest courts.
Yes.
So maybe the best place to do it. What about pressure on the coroner during that inquest?
Well,
is there any?
That's a very good point. This was, after all, the Ministry of Defence, backed by the government, obviously, the establishment put them down, who clearly did not want this to happen under any circumstances. And just before the inquest, the government sort of began to weaken slightly and agreed to have a health survey of surviving members of the Portland Down Volunteers, the group of men. And that was the first thing. They decided to do a statistical study of how these men, how they lived, what illnesses had they had. And that was quite significant. And of course, it turned out that, that most of these people had a very high incidence of cancer and various other things. But that was an interesting development. The government had weakened slightly and okayed that study. So that brings us to the to the inquest. And I can always remember that David Masters made it perfectly clear. And I think it's actually worth quoting him, because, you know, it was one of those landmark moments. And he opened the inquest and he said, "I want to make it clear the facts will be fully, fairly and fiercely investigated. This will be a transparent inquest." And it was.
So the family, Ronald Manister's family, still alive?
Yes. Well, his sister, Lilias, was 18 when he died in 1953, and very emotional. They sat through this inquest, which was going to last 2 months, and it lasted six. A six-month inquest. And she... at the end of it, she actually said to me, she said, you know, he didn't have a life. They took it away from him. And she was right. 20-year-old serviceman. The inquest itself was fascinating. It was harrowing. And it produced a series of facts which really, quite frankly, beggars belief about how these people were duped. And interestingly, expert witnesses were called. Obviously no scientists, because they were dead. And in fact, David Masters, the coroner, made that point. And he actually said, he warned the jury, it was a jury inquest, he warned the jury that the credibility of evidence produced by scientists from Porton Down lacked credibility. He said, you know, I urge you not to take too much notice of it, which in itself, for a coroner to say that, an inquest of this magnitude was another landmark moment. And then I'm sure you can remember the Bristol baby death scandal involving a very high number of deaths involving babies at the Bristol Royal Infirmary. And Sir Ian Kennedy, who carried out the inquiry into that, was called as an expert witness. And he said that Ronald Manison and these young men had been duped ethically. And again, I think it's worth reminding ourselves exactly what Sir Ian Kennedy said. He said that scientists at the time had acted beyond what was ethically acceptable, and that Ronald Madison and the others had been exposed to uncontrollable dangers, and that the test shouldn't have taken place.
So the obvious question is, did this inquest take place because those who had administered this nerve agent to these people were dead and couldn't themselves personally be prosecuted?
I'm not sure about that. I think they would have been called. I think they undoubtedly would have been called. The inquest took place because of a whistleblower had the courage to come across the Atlantic and talk to Wiltshire Police, and Wiltshire Police decided to take him seriously.
So was this idea of testing people for the common cold, was anyone really ever tested for it?
After all this, after 5 years, it was discovered by Wiltshire Police in laboratory records at Porton Down that the establishment had never, ever undertaken any research into finding a cure for the common cold.
So the whole thing was a front, the Common
yes.
Cold Research Centre?
Yes.
Because that was where many people came, wasn't
was
it?
Yes, Salisbury? That was separate. But at Porton Down itself, in the Chemical and Biological Warfare Centre, Research Centre, it never happened there.
So these servicemen went to Porton Down, not to the Common Cold Research Centre?
They went to Porton Down.
OK, so what about the verdict at the inquest?
Well, after 6 months, we'd had these dramatic discussions. Indeed, there were discussions of how you died, how you felt in the gas chamber at Porton, and we produced these hitherto unseen pictures of people on trainmats going backwards and forwards with full masks on. It was something like out of a horror film. Just terrible. Well, of course, there were three possible verdicts. There was misadventure, the same as in 1953. An open verdict. A misadventure, I think, was highly unlikely. None of us thought it would be misadventure. The danger was, from the family's point of view and from the police's point of view, that it could have been an open verdict, which would have left everything hanging in the air. It would have been, no questions would have been answered, and it would have been a disaster. Or unlawful killing. Unanimously, the jury, absolutely bang on the money, said unlawful killing, which is exactly what the police wanted and what the family wanted. And I have to say, one should never, ever get involved in the emotions of these events. Then you lose clarity and you lose discretion and you lose objectivity, and you mustn't do that as a journalist. You mustn't do that. But I have to say, I thought, yes, a good result. And I thought that was very, very important. And of course, it did open up. It opened up, quite important, it opened up the possibility of a compensation and further legal action. And it thoroughly embarrassed the government, and it thoroughly embarrassed Porton Down.
So what's your feeling about the whole affair, looking back on it?
Well, I think that it was something that had to be done. The fact that it took over 50 years to get to that stage. And I think that, to sum it up, it was a huge and disgraceful episode in British history. Balanced against that, of course, and you must find balance. The culture was different. It was the Cold War. When, in fact, the value of the individual was somewhat reduced. And as I said before, the government was arguing that the Soviets were knocking on the door, and, in fact, the Soviets were carrying out exactly the same experiments. And you could say there was no difference, because in Russia you certainly wouldn't be able to have, you wouldn't have been able to say, no, I'm not taking part. But we were no better. The UK was no better. In a way, morally, probably worse, because people were duped into going, and that's very wrong indeed. And after this, statistically it was found out that around about 20,000 people from about 1946 to 1989 had taken part in experiments at Porton Down, not necessarily with sarin nerve gas. That would be wrong to say that. The problem was that is that it was all unnecessary. And why deny it? This is the denying taking place. And, of course, it spawned all sorts of other theories, not all entirely proved. For instance, David Kelly was head of biological experiments at Porton Down, and we all know what happened to him and why did it happen to him. But that's, of course, a separate story. And if you want me to sum it up, I think that Wiltshire Police, a force which I have to say has had its ups and downs, came out with an immense credit for a small rural force to carry out this sort of investigation. It cost in the end £3 million, which is an astonishing amount of money for Wiltshire Police. And to see a traditional and establishment figure like David Masters, who held his nerve and indeed made sure that the truth was found. The good guys actually won for once.
In January 2008, there were compensation payments.
Indeed.
£8,300 per person. Around about 350 people.
Yes. Princely sum, wasn't it?
And that's how much it costs to have nerve gas put on you.
Yes.
Were these all with sarin nerve gas, or were there other substances?
It's unknown.
Okay, so they wouldn't say.
They wouldn't say.
There is a saying, apparently, at Porton Down, never apologise, never explain.
I've never seen that written down.
No. So they don't write things down like that. Also, in 2015, you mentioned a lot of guinea pigs, 22,000 or so, between around about 1940 and 1990. But there are also, the records were revealed in 2015, something like 750 secret operations by Porton Down around Britain, testing biological agents on the general population, including places like the London Underground. Well, I wonder if any information about this came out.
Oh, well, actually, Tony, much closer to home. Much closer to home. The whole of the South West, and Bristol in particular, was experimented on. Only people at the time didn't know. A plume of substances were put up into the air, and it drifted across the South West. The idea was to see what would happen if an atomic bomb went off, and how many people would die, and how long it would take to people die. And that was thrown up during the BBC investigation, and I remember doing a very long piece about this and got the science on it, and got the paperwork. At the time, Porton Down refused. There was an argument that there was some radioactivity released. Couldn't prove it, and Porton Down denied it. And I actually think, even by Porton Down standards, I think that's highly unlikely. But the experiment certainly took place across Bristol and the southwest to see how far the wind would blow radiation particles.
And that's just one of 750 of these experiments.
Well, it's the only one that I investigated, and I can talk about that with some clarity, but the others I don't know.
Now, when I was working in Salisbury, I can remember this question about Gulf War syndrome.
Yes.
This is something else, yes. I think, which people have pointed the finger at Porton Down over, saying what that was happening with soldiers going out to the first Gulf War in 1990 were given a lot of injections.
They were.
And I wonder what you make of that, because obviously Porton Down would have been involved in the sorts of treatments, whatever was given to people. They would have experimented on these substances beforehand, possibly.
Yes. I didn't do any work on the Gulf War syndrome, so I can't answer you. But I can say that probably 40 years ago, definitely 40 years ago, I went into the gas chamber at Porton Down, and this was all before this, and interviewed the head of the establishment, and it was all extremely polite. And I didn't really take it that seriously. It was an unpleasant feeling. But, of course, if I had known what I know now, you wouldn't have found me within 500 yards of the place. In fact, probably a mile. There was a well-known theory about Gulf War syndrome, but I haven't done an investigation of that, so I can't answer it.
The other thing I must ask you about is the 4th of March 2018, we had the Salisbury poisonings.
Now, indeed.
This is only 10 minutes away from Porton Down. I mean, some people have said, well, isn't it possible that whatever substance was used in Salisbury just was from 10 minutes away, rather than from somewhere across the world?
Yes. I think, on the other hand, if it hadn't been, 15 minutes away, 20 minutes actually, I don't know how fast you drive, Tony.
Probably too far.
Yes, I think that on the balance, it was possibly, if there was, and if we agree with the government on this, that there was a chemical weapons attack on a British city, then it was just as well it was 15 minutes away from Porton Down. I don't think anywhere else in the country would have had the faintest idea what they were dealing with. And ordinary people in Salisbury, decent ordinary people, would probably have died. The information came back very quickly from Porton Down. The argument, the morality of Porton Down, of course, is another subject altogether. Vaccines have been developed there. They are, we believe, we are told, are working on a vaccine for COVID-19, which will not be a bad thing. It would prevent the deaths of perhaps hundreds of thousands of people. I think the evidence is still waiting to see where we are.
There's
with Nokhachev.
There's one particular question about this attack in Salisbury, and that is that, judging by the experiments on soldiers, this is incredibly lethal material. I would have imagined that if this had been a professional state operation, that both Sergei and Yulia Skripal would not still be with us. This is incredibly dangerous stuff.
Indeed.
A little tiny drop of it will kill you. Mm. How come they're still alive?
You'd have to ask the scientists. I do think that if the information that has come out is to be believed, that the alleged two government Russian agents were having fun time with a prostitute and doing a bag of weed the night before, may sort of impair their expertise, perhaps, when they went down for the second time after scoping out Salisbury to go down for the second time. They weren't at their best, perhaps. I think what we need to know is we need to know the investigation, the criminal investigation into what was murder, made public. And of course, as you know, you can't make that information public until there has been a trial, if there will be a trial. And of course, it's quite obvious that it's highly unlikely that the two alleged Russian agents will ever be extradited from Moscow to come and face a trial at Winchester. I don't think it's going to happen. It should happen, and then we will know the evidence. Until we know the evidence, I don't think we can make a statement.
Okay, there's another aspect, Portendown, and that is slowly over the last 20 years or so, there has been talk of and there has been a degree of privatisation. Do you think that's changed the way it works?
I'm uncomfortable with it being privatised. You bring the profit motive in, and people may take shortcuts. I'm not saying that there's lack of expertise. The expertise may remain the same. But I'm uncomfortable with something so important to the country being put in the hands of private industry, where history tells us shortcuts are taken in the effort to satisfy the shareholders. I think I would prefer, if we are to have a research establishment, it should be controlled by the government.
There is a worldwide ban on chemical and biological weapons. Should Portendown even exist?
Well, there's been a ban since 1989 about experiments on human beings at Portendown. That ended in 1989. There was a ban imposed by the government on the use of human beings at Portendown, which is often sometimes forgotten, and that's what happened. I think we can only look upon our own experiences. COVID-19, is the last count, has caused 42,000 deaths in this country. And I would prefer to know what was going to kill me or what's going to kill my family, because do something about it. If it's not there.
Couldn't that be done on a civilian program? Why military? Why are the military still experimenting with these substances when there's a worldwide ban in place?
You'd have to ask them.
The inquest was carried out by this chap, David Masters. Mm. Do you think the same sort of thing could still happen today?
You'd like to think so, wouldn't you? I'd like to think so. But he was an exceptional coroner. There have been one or two in the West Country. There have been one or two. And you've met another one.
Paul Forrest from Raven Somerset.
Indeed. Another exceptional coroner of the same generation, I might add. I don't know. We haven't seen any mistakes yet. And if there are mistakes made, then we'll have to look into them. But David Masters was exceptional. He gave great access to the media. Well, he gave great access to the BBC and indeed others. And wasn't for turning. He stood up to the establishment and made sure there was a properly carried out inquest. And he got to the bottom of it.
There is an aspect with public officials now that sometimes they cherry-pick journalists. So if a journalist is quite critical, then that journalist may be blacklisted and won't get the stories, won't get cooperation from their press office and that sort of thing. Have you seen that in coroner's offices? Have you seen that in your work over the last 10, 15 years, where if you report negatively on somebody, that a public official, then you may find yourself cut off from getting interviewed?
Well, I think it depends. If you get it right, if you get it right, then you're right, and they can do nothing about it. Most people would say that I've been a bit at odds with the establishment for most of my career. My experience is that the first thing is to get it right. Check the facts, prove it, have the evidence, and put it to them. And if they don't like you, you broadcast it. And then they're left looking silly. My experience is that as long as you don't lie, I find that very, very disagreeable fact that some journalists spin it before actually getting the facts, and I'm not a supporter of that whatsoever. If you cross them, well, that's just part of it. If you fall out with them, you fall out with them. I've fallen out with one or two in my career. But I've also had good experiences, and one of them was Portland Down. I like to think that I played a very minor part in exposing what had happened at Portland Down.
So that's Steve Brodie, former Home Affairs correspondent for BBC in the West of England. Martin, quite a lot to discuss from that, but I suppose one of the main things is at the inquest, as Steve described there, they're talking about the Portland Down evidence lacking credibility. This is the coroner himself saying this evidence you're putting forward lacks credibility.
Well, I mean, what you're seeing there is that the state is not a monolith. So the Crown Prosecution Service and the Wiltshire Police, who are paid for out of general taxation, are not necessarily on the same page of Portland Down, which again is paid for out of general taxation.
Well, just to be clear, with the Crown Prosecution Service, were not at all helpful. They made sure there was no criminal investigation into these deaths, which would possibly have meant some of the scientists or lab assistants, people like that, maybe even former directors of Portland Down would have gone to jail. But certainly the coroner and the local police force in Wiltshire showed their independence to these national institutions.
Yeah, but they, not in 1954, they didn't. But it's a harrowing story, and frankly, I have to say that it's probably the tip of the iceberg of what's really been going on there for all these years. Your point that you were making to your interviewee there about, you know, should Portland Down exist at all? I think that's a very good point. Why do you need military investigation into these things when there's a worldwide ban on these weapons? And don't forget that Putin talked to Assad after the supposed chemical weapons attack at Douma, which of course we now probably, you know, pretty obviously wasn't carried out by the Syrians anyway. It was carried out by the rebels, probably supplied by our intelligence services, possibly from Portland Down. And the Syrians got rid of their chemical weapons because they don't have a real use in modern warfare. They were never much use in the first place. In the First World War, the chemical weapons were very, you know, they basically blew back over your own troops and all sorts of things like that. They were used by Saddam in the Gulf War, in the Iran-Iraq War, but of course that was all supplied by the West as well, as we all know.
And the big scandal, of course, really, that Steve helped expose there was the lies told not only to the original inquest, but also to those hundreds and hundreds of servicemen that thought they were going to get a little bit of extra pay by being tested for the common cold. They ended up being guinea pigs for the most lethal substance known to man.
Well, yes. And that's the sort, I mean, there's also the story about what happened in Lynmouth, because the RAF were testing, this come out under freedom of information legislation. They were testing rainmaking on Exmoor, and they successfully made rain on Exmoor, and they, at Cranford, they'd all got the bubbly out, and they were saying, this is great, we've managed to make rain. But that's what led to the Lynmouth flood, which killed 15 people, which of course has been treated ever since as if it was just a natural disaster, but it wasn't.
There's also these hundreds of tests by Portendown. I mean, don't think anyone's saying that they were necessarily releasing sarin nerve gas on the public, but they were doing these tests to see how quickly substances spread around. And they were using bacteria and various substances which hadn't really been properly tested, so it could have actually caused harm too. The other thing, of course, is the Wiltshire gas chamber. I didn't actually realise that Wiltshire had its own gas chambers and probably still does.
Well, I mean, I don't know anything about the Wiltshire gas chambers, so it's hard to comment. But I think the story around what happened to the Skripals just doesn't add up. I mean, if they were using Novichok, A, they'd be dead, and B, lots of other people would be dead. And of course, the programme that the BBC is showing doesn't mention that the first person on the scene just happened to be the most senior nurse in the British Army and various other anomalies in the British story.
She was from the Air Force, wasn't she?
Well, she was a senior military nurse.
Yeah. I mean, also, you mentioned...
She just happened to be on... that only came out because her daughter, who was with her, got some award from a local radio station, and her mother came along with her and said that she would... So, in other words, just by coincidence, she's just happened to be there. And of course, they also have the doctor at Salisbury General Hospital who wrote to the Times saying, we have not treated anybody for nerve agents in this hospital today, and that includes Skripal and his daughter, because what they were initially treated for, because it looked like a drugs overdose, fentanyl or something of that sort. Novichok doesn't work like that. Novichok just kills you dead. You don't go for to the pub and to the restaurant and all these other places, and they supposedly picked it up off a doorknob. And then they went out for a pub lunch and to feed the ducks. And then some hours later, both of them are found frothing at the mouth on a bench. And then just so happens by the senior military nurse in the British Army or the British military. Now, nothing of that will come out in this BBC documentary film, whatever it is that they've made. And of course, it's that you can sense that there's some kind of psychological warfare narrative creation here.
Most people looking at what happened in Salisbury will be thinking, well, what could possibly be the motive? But we know, don't we, that there is a secret intelligence operation, not necessarily so secret, because I believe it was a French former intelligence officer that revealed it, called Operation Beluga, the idea being to basically blacken the name of Russia to smear Putin in the international press. And it could simply be an intelligence operation named Beluga.
Well, it's Beluga. People can look this up. It was Paul Burrell, who was a head of the French anti-terrorist squad, who told us the name of the operation. And basically also the death of Berezovsky. The coroner in Surrey refused to sign it off as suicide. Now, you'd have thought that the media in the West, when Berezovsky, Putin's major political opponent, supposedly commits suicide, but it turns out it wasn't suicide, and the coroner wouldn't accept that it was suicide, you'd have thought they'd have picked that up and blasted it all over the place like Litvinenko. But they didn't. They didn't, because Berezovsky's daughter has been on Russian TV to say, as far as she's concerned, it was the British who killed Berezovsky. And of course, you then get into this kind of what you've got in the mainstream media and mainstream establishment opinion in the West is, we don't do things like that, so that can't have happened. Although in actual fact, if you're Russian, it's quite straightforward. The British killed him, because the British do kill people. The idea that we don't do stuff like that is just for the birds, isn't it?
Well, and also I think we have to give a big pat on the back to Jerry Luckett and the CID at Wiltshire Constabulary for pursuing basically the entire establishment they took on when they took on that inquest.
Yes, and of course some of the people have got compensation, but of course the truth is that many of them probably had long-term health issues as a result of being exposed to these substances.
And as Steve pointed out, many of them, of course, are dead as well. The other aspect to all of this is Dr. David Kelly and his mysterious death in 2003. Steve mentioned there.
Yes. Well, I mean, we're now ranging out across all the sort of things that go on. But the fact of the matter is,
because Kelly was one of the chief scientific officers at Portendown,
yes,
wasn't he?
Yes. And of course, he was involved in the trip to South Africa with David Cameron and Sir
Kenneth Warren.
To negotiate about what was going to happen to South Africa's nuclear weapons at the end of apartheid. Basically, the British deep state is as devious as you could possibly imagine.
I mean, that whole
trip, guys, we don't do nasty stuff. It's just wrong.
That whole trip has an aspect of white supremacist to it, doesn't it? Because they didn't want nuclear weapons to fall into the hand of the black majority rule in South Africa.
No, they didn't. And the other thing that they were doing in South Africa was weaponizing anthrax for use in artillery shells, which could then be fired into the townships. As you can imagine, the more you look into the arms industry, the military intelligence establishment, the intelligence services, the dirtier it all gets. And, of course, the idea that these people are basically good guys and we don't need to know what they're up to because they're basically protecting us from evil is simply wrong. It's just wrong.
So there are a couple of books on the death of David Kelly, aren't there? There's one by Norman Baker, I think he was, Lib Dem MP, and another one by Miles Goslett more recently, both of whom actually I've interviewed about their books. And many people didn't realise, Martin, that he even had a connection with Porton Down, the Nuclear and Chemical and Biological Weapons Research Centre.
He was somebody who, classically, somebody who knew too much. And again, what happened there was no coroner's inquest because you can't commit suicide in the way that they suggested he committed suicide. So there wasn't a coroner's inquest. Tony Blair went straight to an inquiry to avoid having a coroner's inquest. And what this shows, in fact, and the same with what happened with Berezovsky, is that if you can get the genuine machinery of the judiciary to operate, then you can start to look into what the deep state gets up to. And, of course, we saw this also in Italy with Imposimato, the head of the Supreme Court there, investigating all of the terrorism associated with Gladio. The fact is, ultimately, we're going to have to turn honest coppers on the deep state. That's the strategy.
Okay, so thank you very much to Martin Summers there and also to former West of England BBC Home Affairs correspondent Steve Brodie for taking us right the way, really, I think, very thorough investigation into Porton Down, the Chemical and Biological Weapons Centre near Salisbury. And I think what we'll do is we will have a chat to Martin in a minute as we take our weekly look around the world.
Most of us just sell out right away.
Yeah.
from 2000. That's the Cuban Boys with Inertia Kicks from their album Eastwood. Welcome back to the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. China kills 20 Indian soldiers at a remote mountain border in the Himalayas, and North Korea blows up a liaison centre with South Korea. That's not very friendly, is it? Just who is sending a signal to who there? And the Lockerbie bombing, we hear from David Pidcock, who worked on Channel 4's Maltese Double Cross film with the filmmaker Alan Frankovich, the famous, I should say, and amazing, probably one of the greatest documentary directors of all time, Alan Frankovich, and explains the bizarre connection between Lockerbie and 9/11. Also, the latest installment of the sordid tale of King George VI and Winston Churchill's alleged collaboration with Hitler's private secretary and leader of the Nazi party, who disappeared at the end of World War II with all the signatories to all the bank accounts. That's Martin Bormann. The prize being these people's share in $1 billion or so US dollars worth of Nazi loot. Well, is this the biggest cover-up of the 20th century? I think it is, and I'm trying to uncover it lie by lie this week. Two more layers of the Bormann cover-up stripped away. Author of Aftermath, Martin Bormann and the Fourth Reich, Ladislaus Farago's publisher. Old school New York Times investigative journalist, former head of the New York Times book publishing arm, that's Thomas Lipscomb. He gives us his long view after 50 years of investigative journalism on whether or not Bormann survived. Plus, Frank Brandenburg's 1990 book called Quest. Interviews with 11 former SS Nazis, the majority confirming Bormann did survive the war, most of the rest blowing their top when the question is asked of them. In the late 1980s, two of these former, or is it current, SS men claimed to have personally met Bormann after the war. One, Medard Klapper, now running a gun shop in Karlsruhe, said he met him as recently as 1982. Also, what were the secret codes Herr Brandenburg reveals to let you into those Fourth Reich plotters' confidence? But Martin, we've got to start with tensions in Asia, both North and South Korea and China, India. Where do you think is the most serious?
Well, obviously more potentially more serious in North and South Korea because of the potential for a conflict dragging in the US straight away and so on. But of course, very worrying whichever way you look at it. What's going on really, I think, is the US is determined to basically confront China, and underlying all of this, Narendra Modi has been pushing.
Hang on, Martin, before you carry on there, because it looks to me as if both in North Korea and in India, it's China that's doing the confronting, not the US.
No, hang on a minute. In North Korea, the Chinese have not been involved directly.
Well, yes, but it's a client state of theirs, isn't it?
No, it's not. It's not. They are allied with North Korea, but they find them very difficult to deal with. The North Koreans have actually got rather an independent line.
Is it bit like the relationship between the US and Israel, say?
Yes. Yes, that would be a comparable. Although it's not as close as the relationship between the US and Israel. Narendra Modi is pushing. Don't forget that all of this is in Jammu and Kashmir, and in actual fact, there's a question about whether India should be on that border at all. Because if Jammu and Kashmir was independent or part of Pakistan, then the Indians wouldn't be there at all. And Modi is basically trying to provoke the Chinese. I think that's what's going on, and the Chinese are responding to his provocations. Because
Why would Modi want to do that?
Because Modi is reorienting Indian policy away from being neutral between China and the US to having a more pro-US policy. Traditionally, the Congress governments in India took a non-aligned stance, but Modi wants to get into bed with Trump. They get on quite well, and they've got very similar ideas.
Well, they're also both close to Israel, aren't they?
Yeah, that's right. So, in other words, what India is doing is playing its part in the bait China game, which Trump is using to try and get re-elected. And of course, he may have bitten off more than he can chew. Because isn't it extraordinary that you've got two nuclear armed powers and they actually end up bashing each other with baseball bats and rocks? And you couldn't make it up, could you?
Well, apparently, I saw a picture today, apparently, of some kind of... I mean, you never really know with these military-released pictures whether they're real, but apparently some kind of giant metal spike with loads of other spikes off of it that apparently the Chinese were using to beat the Indian soldiers, where they actually killed 20 of them altogether, allegedly.
Well, and also the Chinese, I think, have admitted that they had casualties as well. And, of course, both sides basically had an unwritten understanding that nobody is to be carrying firearms, which is why they've ended up fighting like a big brawl outside a pub. But, of course, it's potentially dangerous. But, as I say, don't forget Jammu and Kashmir. Modi has basically ended the autonomy of Jammu and Kashmir, and of course most of the people there aren't very happy about that at all. And of course, if they had their way, then there wouldn't necessarily be an Indian army there to confront the Chinese on this border. So the whole thing is very worrying, and it looks very, you know, the more you look at the world today, the closer it looks to the run-up to World War One, where all sorts of conflicts are potentially going to go off, and political leaders all over the place are basically looking to create conflict in order to divert attention from their own failings.
We've had some interesting revelations from John Bolton this week. I suppose that might also be considered to be electioneering. Is Trump right when he says that Bolton has been saying these things about Trump because he was annoyed about being sacked by him?
I think this, I mean, it's hard to know because we can't get in the minds of these people. But Bolton obviously doesn't like being sacked by Trump. And don't forget, Bolton is 100% deep state man. And Trump is regarded by those people as not entirely reliable. So obviously Bolton has timed this book and the revelations in it to try and mess Trump up. I don't think there's much doubt about that. And of course, the things he's saying sound credible. But nevertheless, it doesn't change anything very much. We knew that Trump was a chump, and we didn't need Bolton to tell us.
Well, also, we've heard that Trump is saying he didn't know. I mean, it doesn't give you a great idea of how switched on the president is. He didn't know what Iraq when he first hired him. So he's kind of saying, well, this guy, I hired him in good faith, and it didn't really seem like he knew what he was doing most of the time. And his stance, of course, on Iraq was very much a hawkish one. You know, I suppose Trump has been on the opposite side. It seems to me he's been trying to sort of disengage, knowing that that's what he promised. But we'll say, what do you think about Bolton, Trump and Iraq?
Well, I think Bolton has always been a hawk on Iraq, on Iran, on everything, really. He's 100%, you know, he didn't see a war he didn't like. Trump, it's basically, you know, he went along with the assassination of Soleimani, for example. He's got his own track record for being a provocateur.
Bolton said that the Iraq war was a great idea and it was a great success. So, I mean, surely how can anybody actually say that?
Well, for some people, it has been a great success. The military-industrial complex in the US has now got a blank check to get money to do anything it wants. And people die. That's not really an issue for them. And if Iraq gets reduced to rubble, that's not really a problem for them. They've created further problems for Assad and Syria. Israel's enemies have been discomforted. I mean, if you are a warmonger, then Iraq hasn't been a disaster at all. It's just the poor people who live there who've had to pay the price.
And Trump is saying also today that decoupling from China is on the table. Pompeo's has a 7-hour meeting with a Chinese diplomat, and he just comes out saying, well, divisions remain. I mean, is this moving towards having little or no trade, little or no diplomatic relations with China?
Well, the thing is that China and the US are intimately related at the moment through you could envisage in the future that they may drift apart. I mean, I was reading a Chinese person earlier from the government saying, well, we may have to think in terms of building up our own economy rather than selling things to other people. because if we lose the US market, that's going to really undermine what we're trying to do. I mean, the whole idea of the Chinese getting into the US market and the US allowing that to happen was that the trade would lead to a situation where war would be unthinkable. But of course, the it's quite clear that the deep state in the US does not accept an independent China, and they don't accept an independent Russia. And it's nothing to do with the internal political arrangements in those countries. They just don't want to deal with countries which have got independence from their system. And they are, you know, they're going for broke in terms of trying to break both those systems down. But of course, it's not as easy as they think.
Some chap called Doug Bando, who's been writing about the whole geopolitical situation with the Americans and China, is saying that actually Washington is complaining because China is starting to do what we always do. In other words, I suppose he's talking there about provocations like what's going on in India.
Well, ultimately, if you go around provoking people like the assassination of Soleimani at the beginning of the year, it's only because the Iranians showed restraint that we didn't go all out war right there and then. And it's only because the Americans showed restraint without trying not to shoot at the tankers which were bringing oil from Iran to Venezuela that we didn't go to war then. But of all around the world, there are a number of flashpoints. There's just about to be the annexation of the West Bank by the Israelis in defiance of international law. That could lead to a war. There's all these conflicts around the world, which are related to all these big geopolitical struggles, and also to do with the nation, you know, the economy and the banking system being as shot away as it is. I mean, this is just about a perfect storm for ongoing conflict.
So I thought a lot of people have been talking about Bill Gates quite rightly as someone who's very, very much involved with vaccines, particularly powerful at the World Health Organization, using his foundation to fund many departments at influential universities around the Western world, which look into vaccines. I think it was Robert F. Kennedy that wrote a really damning article about Gates' involvement with various vaccine trial programs in the developing world, where one by one it's been pointed out that these vaccines have been killing people rather than protecting them from health. But of course, the implication here is that it's okay to do that in countries where poor people or people that don't speak English, don't speak our language, can be guinea pigs, effectively, rather like porting down guinea pigs for Bill Gates and his vaccines. But William Engdahl's pointed out in the last week or so Bill Gates' connection also with the Arctic Doomsday Seed Vault. That's what he calls it. I don't think it's officially called the Doomsday Vault. It's in a place called Svalbard, which is an island near the north of Greenland. It's quite a long way north of Iceland, where he says, against the backdrop of spreading fear about global coronavirus pandemic, an event slipped largely under the radar at a spot so removed from the rest of the world that most are unaware of its existence. The Svalbard Doomsday Seed Vault on Spitsbergen Island, north of the Arctic Circle, just received an additional major shipment of plant variety seeds for its special storage. What makes this entire seed bank enterprise suspicious, at the very least, is the list of financial sponsors behind the global project. So on February the 25th, more than 60,000 new seed varieties were placed in the vault, the largest deposits of seeds since it operated. This brings the total of seed types to over 1 million since the vault was opened in early 2008. The guar beans from Central Asia, corn seeds, sacred to the Cherokee nations, wild flowers from a meadow at Prince Charles's Highgrove home. The vault is the island which is legally part of Norway since a 1925 treaty. But it's the corporate sponsors that bother him, Martin. And he finishes his article with the following paragraph. He says, a virtually inaccessible seed vault under the control of some of the world's foremost advocates of eugenics and population reduction is definitely remarkable. With more than 1 million of the irreplaceable seed heritage of the world locked inside the Svalbard seed vault, could this be a way for GMO agribusiness giants like Bayer, Monsanto or Syngenta to illegally gain access to those seeds in time of global crisis? It sounds far-fetched. Yet there are far-fetched goings-on in our world. We could say he who controls the world's crop seeds controls the world. So not only is Gates involved in the this vaccine program, Martin, not only for COVID-19, but in other ways, and controlling policy on health around the world through the World Health Organization and through his funding, he's also got his finger in the pie when it comes to our future seeds for the world in order to actually grow food. Incredible, really.
It is, and you'd have thought in a rational world, these kinds of things, like having a, you know, collecting all the world's seeds and to make sure that, you know, that you don't lose them, that should be under the control of governments who are basically answerable to the people for what they do with the material. And this whole idea that corporations should be, you know, major funders of all of this. And of course, it's always presented as philanthropy as well. I mean, Bill Gates is a businessman. He's not a philanthropist. He's there to make money. That's what he's about.
And he's a monopolist. He's not just an ordinary businessman. He's a monopolist in the tradition of John D. Rockefeller, you know, who monopolized the oil production. I mean, he did what's called vertical integration, where you own not only the gas stations in the States, petrol stations, but you also own the entire supply chain, the franchises and the concessions to take oil out, to transport the oil. You own the railways that are doing that. You also own the refineries. You own the whole entire system. And then you can just simply change, rack up the price to whatever you feel like that day.
Well, you know, what you do is you make the price which maximizes your profit. You know, that's what monopolists do. But I mean, the corporate power has taken over the West completely, and they want to run everything, and they've been, you know, they have endless ambition, and you know, all of these, you know, they basically want full spectrum dominance of everything. They want to control seeds. They want to control genetic material. They want to control healthcare. They want military control. They want everything.
Bill Gates' thing is Microsoft. Obviously, the vast majority of computers in the world have got Microsoft as their operating system. And once they've obtained their monopoly, which they virtually have now, what happens is every time you get your new Microsoft, there are only certain other Microsoft products that will work with it. Now, the EU, for a while, was quite good at stopping this monopoly, but it's really completely ineffective now, as it's actually very, very difficult to launch products which work effectively with Microsoft. And I've seen that myself on various occasions. But look, there's another aspect, another thing I'd like to talk about this week, Martin, and that's what's been going on in Seattle. Members of the African American Council were booed, apparently, as they told protesters in Seattle's autonomous zone that they have hijacked the Black Lives Matter movement by pushing other causes like higher taxes for Amazon. So there's just one headline. But this autonomous area in Seattle, they call it Syria in Seattle, that commune defies the US regime. So what do you make of what's going on in Seattle?
Well, you've obviously got quite a lot of noise and more heat than light coming out of this. I mean, it seems to me that the local authorities in Seattle, which is a more liberal Democrat-controlled city, have basically turned a blind eye to the creation of this autonomous zone over six blocks in the city. But I can't, you know, you can see that it's creating antagonism at the other end of the political spectrum. People saying, oh, how are these people allowed to do this, etc. And it's not even clear what's going on, who's in charge of it, whether the police have access at the moment. They don't, but what if somebody's murdered in there? It seems to me, it's in theory, it's classical anarchism. In practice, it's possibly deep state manipulation of everybody concerned.
Okay, so we're going to have a listen now to David Pidcock, who I spoke to a couple of weeks ago. He happened to be involved with the director, Alan Frankovich. And maybe before we hear from David, you can say something about Alan Martin, because he started off with making a blockbuster documentary series called On Company Business about the Central Intelligence Agency. He was actually born to a Peruvian mining family, and he went to study film in Los Angeles. But probably his most famous documentary series is the Operation Gladio series that he made for the BBC, isn't it?
It is. And the way he worked is he collected material for years and years and years and years and years without using it, so that he could carry on getting interviews with people who were happy to talk to him, even though they weren't quite sure what he was doing. And he was very crafty about that. So there's a three-part documentary that was shown in the Time Shift series in 1993 about Gladio. And, of course, he actually got interviews with a lot of the...
Yeah, it's Time Watch.
Time Watch, sorry, yeah. And he got interviews with a lot of the top people, for example, from Sismi in Italy, basically saying, yes, we did all of these things. We killed all these people. And there it was on BBC. And it's out there, and everybody should watch it, although you can't see the BBC version. You can just see a pirate version, which I think you were responsible for putting up there.
Well, I was partly. I mean, it was actually, I believe, it was recorded in a journalism school down in Falmouth at the time for journalism students, and it was impossible to actually get copies of this from the BBC. In fact, when we were working on the Conspiracy Files programme, as you remember, Martin, the BBC, the I can't remember the guy's name, but Tristan Quinn, maybe.
Yeah.
He tried to get copies for us and couldn't, although he did manage to watch them himself. So apparently they're still there. Of course, we do know that there are individuals. In fact, the guy who was in charge of Newsnight when the Jimmy Savile piece was pulled, he was sacked from Newsnight, but he went on to take over control of the BBC archive. So he's the sort of person that would say, oh, well, this Gladio series is not important anymore. I think we should just wipe the tapes. But they do exist, thankfully, and they're up online now. And so that was well worth watching. But anyway, let's have a listen now to David Pidcock, who worked on this film, which we can discuss a little bit afterwards, called The Maltese Double Cross, about the Lockerbie bombing. So here's David Pidcock now.
My name is David Pidcock. To my Muslim friends, I'm Dawood Musa, David Moses. I converted to Islam in 1975 and became particularly interested in Middle East politics.
And I know, David, that you got quite involved, didn't you, with the Lockerbie attack. Now, this was Pan Am Flight 103, which was a flight from Frankfurt to Detroit via London and New York. So that's what they used to do in those days. Yeah. You know, you wouldn't get just a flight from A to B. You would quite often stop several times on the way. Yeah. And that's what Pan Am Flight 103 did. But there was a bomb on that plane. And when it was flying up into Scotland on its way to New York, there was a massive explosion. And actually, it's probably fair to say that that was the reason why we didn't have Pan Am anymore. Pan Am was gotten rid of because it was associated with Pan Am Flight 103 and Lockerbie. But at the time, this was believed to have been a Libyan terrorist carrying out this. Can you just take us through, you know, you did quite a lot of investigation at the time, and you were with some quite well-known people looking into what really happened at Lockerbie.
Yeah, yeah, because and the evidence that came out on the Daily Mirror on the morning of 9/11.
Oh, okay, so it came out 13 years after.
Lockerbie, the lost evidence. Daily Mirror, world exclusive. So on the morning of 9/11, 5 a.m., 0500, whatever it was, the Daily Mirror, Lockerbie, the voice of the Mirror, calls for an investigation. Ray Manley was the guard on the perimeter fence at Heathrow. During the port visit, I found that the padlock had been broken off the doors leading to airside. That was Wednesday, 21st of December, 1998. And his handwritten thing is there. But why was he not called to give evidence at the trial?
The official story is that the bomb had been put in Malta, I believe, before the plane had taken off. But what you're saying is that there was also a break-in to Heathrow. So the bomb might have been put on the Lockerbie plane.
It was definitely put on because of the barometric timer. We know all about that. It was not put on in Malta. And the guys in Malta were admitted later that they received $1 million to fake it. So we've got all that. But this is the important thing. Lockerbie, the truth must come out. And Ray Manley was the one who was never called to give evidence. And why would you think that would be strange or unstrange? I would think it was highly, because they didn't want to be undone, because Megrahi was falsely charged because they wanted to blame an Arab. It's always about blaming Adams.
Okay, so you were involved with the making of a film about Lockerbie too, weren't you? Can you tell us how that happened?
Well, it was Alan Frankovich, and we wanted to make a film, and it was Dr. Swire, whose daughter was killed on the plane. We were very close with him, and he wanted to get to the truth, and he believed that McGrahee was innocent, and the whole thing, the headline from the Express, admitted saying that the chief of police in Lockerbie in Scotland said that the evidence was faked and put on by the FBI, CIA.
Okay, well, look, who is this guy Frankovich, and how did you meet him?
Well, I met him because we were wanting to find out the truth. And then Dr. Swire, who we were very close with, he, of course, was a key player. So we've got all that information we can provide without any problem. But we were shown in the House of Lords. We showed it, and there was
No. First of all, tell us a bit about this film. What does it show?
Well, it's called The Maltese Double Cross, because the guys in Malta who had the clothing store from which the guys were supposed to purchase clothing from, in which they were secreting stuff, they admitted, and it's on record, that they were paid $1 million to lie. So it wasn't put on in Malta, and it wasn't put on in Frankfurt. But what was put on in Frankfurt was the huge bales of cannabis. And that's what they were all trying to get to when they got to Lockerbie. And there were a lot of rabbis there, too.
Where were the rabbis?
They were there in Lockerbie, because there were a lot of Jews on the flight.
Well, I mean, I suppose that's because, you know, they may be wanting to recover bodies and things like that.
That's right, of course. Of course, absolutely.
Can you just give us a few details from the film? Like, for example, you're talking about cannabis there. Was the idea then, when the wreckage was there, to collect this cannabis, that somebody should make sure that that was taken off the site?
It would also actually raise issues as to, you had this backdoor for smuggling drugs into the United States.
Well, I'd be very surprised, actually, if the Americans needed to import cannabis. They grow it themselves.
Well, they do now, but back then they weren't. They were getting it from places like Lebanon and what have you.
Also, another thing is, did you and Frankovich discover any information about people who were told not to go on that plane at all?
Yes. The South African foreign minister was taken off the plane, and other the person who took his flight to that seat, we know him too. So there were yes, they knew what was going to happen, and the bomb was put on in London. But why wasn't Ray Manley called to give evidence? The police, who knew who faked the so-called timer that was found in dense foliage, and that person was also in charge of investigating 9/11. And it was the guy who was a former head of the FBI over there, who just was running that thing against Donald Trump. But they were then planting passports in 9/11.
Oh, you mean Mueller?
Robert Mueller, yeah, him.
So that's David Pidcock. Martin, quite a lot to get into there. I think briefly it'd be interesting to hear just your one take on Lockerbie. What's the real take home from what really happened there? What was really going on? Because it clearly wasn't. It was used to bash Libya, which has since been destroyed as a country. It's been in an absolutely terrible state. And now Turkish troops down there, slave markets, that sort of thing, which of course never happened under Gaddafi. What was it actually really about? Do we know?
Well, I think we got to. It's a very complicated story, so we got to start with what we do know and move to what we suspect. What we do know, I think, pretty clearly, it wasn't the Libyans. And if you think about it, it doesn't make a lot of sense. The plane never went anywhere near Malta or Libya. They said that the bomb went on in Malta and was put on a connecting plane, which then flew to Frankfurt, and then the the bomb was taken as a piece of luggage onto the plane at Frankfurt without a passenger. Now, there's all sorts of reasons that wouldn't happen. It's totally implausible. So we can. So in other words, the Libyans were made fall guys for whatever happened. So we get, and Megrahi was innocent. And I think that the Scottish police are pretty much saying as much now, that he should never have been sent to prison. And that's why Alex Salmond basically at one stage let him go home on because they didn't want a retrial, which would have shown that he didn't do it. And of course, if he didn't do it, somebody else did. And that's the important point. Who else did it? Now, what your man there was suggesting is that the bomb went on in London. I'm open to that idea, but it may also have gone on in Beirut, which is where the plane flew before it went to Frankfurt. And, of course, what they were doing, the CIA fund a lot of their activities through drug smuggling, and there was a standard one theory is that there was a standard drugs run from Beirut to New York, and the bomb was put on as if it were a drugs shipment. And the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine were able to get the shipment on the plane if they were the guilty party, but just by making it look as if it was the normal CIA drugs shipment, which nobody checked. Now, that's one theory. It could be that the Iranians did it because of the shooting down of their airplane. If you remember, the USS Vincennes had shot down an Iranian aircraft with all hands, everybody on board killed. Other people like Susan Lindauer, who used to work for the CIA, saying, well, she thought it was to do with covering up the CIA's drug lines coming from Beirut. Now, in other words, there are various theories.
I just say a little bit more about Susan Lindauer, because what she was saying was specifically there had been an investigation into the CIA doing drug running, and the investigative team were on the aircraft heading back to the US. That's what the specific point she made.
Yeah. So, in other words, her guess of what happened is different from what the gentleman there said. Although, of course, it doesn't mean that the bomb couldn't have gone on in London, because if you want to kill all the people, you can put the bomb on in Beirut or in London. Anyway, what people have got to realise, and the Maltese Double Cross, I believe the film's still available. People can watch it.
Yes, it is. It's on YouTube.
It was shown on Channel 4 when it was made. I think it's absolutely clear that the Libyans did not do it. And, of course, by framing the Libyans, it follows the goals of the deep state in the West. They want the Libyans to look bad. And then, of course, they were able to bully Gaddafi to basically what the Libyans were told. You're going to have comprehensive sanctions on your country unless you admit to doing this, even though you haven't done it. And Gaddafi basically ordered Megrahi to say he'd done it so that he could lift the sanctions on his country. And, of course, he then tried to get close to the West. And so, look, I'm not trying to cause trouble for you. I want to join the team. And, of course, he was encouraged to do that. Tony Blair went out there to see him, etc. But, of course, you're a damn fool if you take anything that these people say as gospel. And, of course, the price he paid for that was ultimately to be removed by operation, what was it called? Southern Mistral 2012.
Personally, the other thing to say about this is that this whole operation Lockerbie to smear the Libyans happened in parallel with the murder of PC Yvonne Fletcher in 1984, who was fitted up. Basically, the Libyans were fitted up as her killers, although documentary for Channel 4. Murder in St. James, a two-part documentary by, I think it was Fulcrum Films, a very powerful film.
Really
beyond any shadow of a doubt, including using British military medical ballistics experts, that there's no way that she could possibly have been shot, the angle that the bullet went through her body from the Libyan embassy. In fact, it was from a balcony or a neighbouring part of the square, which had been hired by British and American security services that day.
Yes. And I think people have got to realise that the people running the deep state are that wicked that they will kill a young WPC just starting out in her career to make Libya look bad. That is how wicked they are. And they haven't changed. They're as wicked as they've always been. And when these atrocities and murders happen, I've just watched a very good Italian dramatization of the Piazza Fontana bomb in 1969. Again, Western intelligence services killed 14 people in the bank, and used it as a means of trying to control politics inside Italy. They are ruthless, and they see themselves as in a war to control the world, and they are not to be trusted.
It's also, if you're talking about Italy, it's also probably worth mentioning the revelations about the P2, because really it was a kind of parallel government in Italy, wasn't it? It was a secret government that was actually really running the country, and the government itself had become a kind of theatre, really, for people to watch on the news.
Well, doesn't that describe the world we live in? That is the reality, isn't it? Underneath there is what people call politics, and of course this week we haven't really done any boring mainstream politics, not much, and what we're doing is we're pulling back the curtain and showing what really goes on. What most people think of as political argument is basically a show, and underneath the show is the real government, the real state, pursuing its goals in alliance with various powerful forces. Yeah. And I don't think you certainly couldn't call Britain a democracy as things stand, and nor could you call many other Western countries. Yeah,
the deep state. And actually, this is a constant struggle. It even was with that film that David Pidcock was involved in there, and Alan Frankovich died in mysterious circumstances at Houston Airport in the customs hall. It's definitely a struggle. They couldn't even get this on the television as they had planned to. They had to go and make do showings of the film, literally, with a projector in the House of Lords, in the House of Commons, in Parliament, because the broadcasters refused to broadcast it.
Well, it did go out on Channel 4.
It went out on Channel 4 eventually, but, you know, it was a struggle to get that to happen.
Well, the thing is that unless people have seen something on the terrestrial telly, they think it's just conspiracy theory and they don't have to take any notice of it. But if anybody watches, for example, the Frankovich takedown about Gladio on the Time Watch series, but you've got to watch it to realize these people openly say we did all of these things. And the Red Brigade, supposedly, which kidnapped the Aldo Moro, were being run by the intelligence services. They're the ones who kidnapped the prime minister and murdered him because they didn't want him to bring the Italian Communist Party into a coalition government.
Right, so on to our look at the latest instalment in the investigation into the mysterious disappearance of Hitler's private secretary, Martin Bormann, the guy who had the signatures to all the bank accounts. Now, I've just come across this book called Quest. It's by Frank Brandenburg, who was a young man. He was either 18 or 20 years old. Back in the 1980s, he decided that he wanted to find out more about a couple of issues to do with the Second World War. One was the Holocaust, because there are lots of Nazis that had been around during the war that were still alive in the 1980s that said, oh, well, this was just a fairy tale, it never happened. But the other thing he was particularly interested in was discovering the fate of Martin Bormann. And during the book, he goes and speaks to lots and lots of former SS officers and staff, Wilhelm Hottel, Professor German Gressler, Richard Schultz-Cossens, Rudolf Jordan, Arthur Axmann, Dr. Robert Kempner, Heinrich Heim, Hans Müller, Medjard Klapper, Franz Lechner, Hans Bauer, Joachim Tibertius, and Karl Wolff. All of these people worked in senior positions very close to either Bormann or to people who were involved in the Final Solution. And it was quite amazing, really. The reaction, Martin, was almost universal, really. Either these people said, yes, of course, Bormann survived the war if they trusted him and he as a young man, or else they would go absolutely crazy as soon as he asked the question, like, get out of here or no more questions or that sort of thing. So it was obviously a very tetchy topic.
Well, it is. And the kind of things we've just been discussing, the kind of skullduggery of the intelligence services, well, that's because a lot of fascist intelligence personnel and Nazi intelligence personnel, like Reinhard Gehlen, who ends up running the BND in West Germany, were from the Gestapo, and they and the kind of tricks that they used to get up with, like the burning of the Reichstag. This is just, I mean, this is just a stock in trade for these people.
Well, when he went to see Herr Klapper, Herr Klapper had some interesting things to tell him about Bormann. He said, oh, most definitely he is still around. He talked about the name of an organisation that Bormann controlled in the 1980s. It was Mari Borsol, or whatever that means, based in Madrid. Mari from Martin, Bor from Bormann, and Sol, the Spanish word for sun. The purpose, apparently, of the Bormann organisation was to ensure the future will be ours, Klapper said earnestly. The financial matters, I'm just quoting from the book now, the financial matters, for instance, and they are considerable, even on a world scale, real estate, manufacturing plants, all kinds of profitable investments and business ventures controlled by our people, the people of Mari Borsol, both old and new. Again, he smiled his disconcerting smile. Such as you, Nichtwahr, not so. So they were trying to recruit Frank Brandenburg as a young Nazi. Now, he into this kind of Fourth Reich Nazi movement. Now, he had rather cleverly said, lied, but he said that he was a nephew of Martin Bormann, and that's why he was pursuing this and hoping that they wouldn't actually be able to check up. Frank treated it as a rhetorical question, and he didn't say anything. You know, when he tried to recruit him. And he carried on, though, and to guard the papers and documents handed down to us from the Führer and the Third Reich to guide us, Klapper went on, such as the contents of the crates recovered from a concealment in Dresden. The reporters of the popular press have coined the phrase the Fourth Reich. We do not mind. It will be our Reich. The future will be ours. Martin Bormann himself may not live to see the organisation that bears his name become triumphant, he finished. But triumphant it will be. Now, this is a former SS officer talking who survived the war and ended up in Karlsruhe, Martin, running one of the big gun shops there.
Well, I mean, people will be familiar with the general idea that there was a follow-on Nazi international from the Frederick Forsyth book and film The Odessa File. But that was treated as if it was fiction, whereas in actual fact, it's true. And of course, the big cheeses in US and British intelligence at the end of the war were perfectly happy to cooperate under the table with former Nazis of all stripes, because they'd got an overwhelming shared enemy in the Soviet Union. And also because they basically, you know, the oligarchy in the West wants to retain power come what may. And in many respects, you know, the Nazi movement was itself a kind of puppet movement in order to prevent the communist takeover in Germany, etc. And the devil of all these things is in the detail. But there's plenty of information out there for those who've got the will to go and look for it. Paul Manning's book on Bormann being an obvious place to start.
Well, before we hear from I suppose I should call him our star guest, Tom Lipscomb, tonight. I mean, he is an investigative journalist in the States of the very highest order for 30 or 40 years, and also ran the publishing arm of the New York Times. He was also very friendly with Ladislas Fraga, who wrote really the first book on this topic, which was called Aftermath, Martin Bormann and the Fourth Reich, which Stuart Stephen, ex-Bristol journalist, collaborated on, who was by that time the foreign editor at the Daily Express. And they published this famous headline in 1972, Martin Bormann is alive. But before we hear from that, Martin, I think, you know, just to sort of show how important this is today, I'm just looking at, because nowadays, apparently, if you compare the Israeli state or Zionists to the Nazis, you're supposed to be some sort of really evil person. Actually, Ken Livingstone was thrown out of the Labour Party for doing just that, wasn't he? They accused him of saying that Hitler was a Zionist. He never actually said that. He said that Hitler supported Zionism. I mean, isn't that quite clear that he did?
Well, I mean, there's I've got a book here, History Today articles, and one of them is about the trip that was made to Palestine, as it then was, by an SS colonel and a leading Zionist figure to scope out the possibility of German Jews all going to Palestine. And a medal was even struck with a Star of David on one side and a swastika on the other. So this is just historical fact. And of course, the Bormann organisation, when it continued after the war, were quite clear that they were quite keen to have lots of Jewish business people involved, A, to provide cover, and B, because at the end of the day, Bormann's just a gangster. And but what we're talking about here is gangsterism on a huge scale. And in Argentina, the Jewish community was very heavily involved with Bormann's organisation.
Well, when I spoke to Thomas Lipscomb, he explained to me that the person that gave Bormann the idea of putting prominent Jews in charge of his Bormann companies came from Alan Dulles, which I found was amazing. Anyway, look, just to quote this Zionism Exposed in the pages of the New York Times. This is a Jonathan Cook article. Former mayor from London, Ken Livingston, has been wandering in the political wilderness since he pointed out the early sympathies between Zionists and Nazis. Although this has been well documented, discussion of it has been taboo. Now someone called Boehm has addressed it in the New York Times. This is I'll put a link up to this on our show page. This is from 2016, this article. The original sin of such alliances may be traced back to 1941. That's what he says anyway. In a letter to high Nazi officials drafted in 1941 by Avraham Stern, known as Yair, leading early Zionist fighter and member of the 1930s paramilitary group the Irgun, later the founder of another such group, the Lehi or Lehi. In the letter, Stern proposes to collaborate with Herr Hitler on solving the Jewish question by achieving a Jewish-free Europe. The solution can be achieved, Stern continues, only through the settlement of these masses, in the home of the Jewish people, Palestine. To that end, he suggests, collaborate with the Germans' war efforts and establish a Jewish state on a national and totalitarian basis, which will be bound by treaty with the German Reich. Now, these are interesting words, aren't they, Martin, for somebody like Stern from the Stern gang to be saying. It certainly looks as if there's a pretty high-level deal going on there between the Zionists and the Nazis.
Yes, and of course, they were the ones who blew up the King David Hotel, which killed hundreds of civilian employees of the British occupation authorities. And of course, what they were offering was to stab Monty in the back as long as they got what they wanted, which was an independent Jewish state. And the fact is that the Jabotinskyites on the right wing of Jewish politics, or Israeli politics rather, they modelled themselves on the Mussolini's fascist movement. And the idea that there's these opposites can't interact is simply wrong.
So let's have a listen now to Thomas Lipscomb, who I spoke to earlier this week. This is the chap who's he was the editor, really, of the Ladislas Varago book, which was called Aftermath, Martin Bormann in the Fourth Reich, published in the 1970s, the first book really to take seriously the fact that Martin Bormann was very active down in South America. And I think once we've heard this, finally, we'll just round up with a look at, you know, why do I keep using the name Winston Churchill and King George VI in connection with the survival and protection of Bormann after the war?
My name is Thomas Lipscomb. I'm a publisher, editor, and writer based in New York. I've run a couple of different publishing companies. I was the editor for people like Agatha Christie, H.R. Haldeman, and William Sapphire, and any number of top best-selling authors. And I ran the New York Times book company called Times Books. So I've worked a lot with top-selling popular fiction and nonfiction. I've also done my own reporting, investigative reporting for New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, Chicago Sun-Times, New York Sun, etc. And I'm currently writing a book, actually two books, one on the Rudolf Hess mystery and the other one on the JFK assassination.
We're here to talk to you today about a book called Martin Bormann and the Fourth Reich. And this was published by, I believe he's a Hungarian, called Ladislas Varago. What was your involvement with that and who was this guy?
Well, Lotzi, as we called him. Lotzi was a client of a friend of mine named Ivan Obolensky, and he published his book on Patton with Obolensky Books. So Obolensky sent him to see me because he had a new book in mind, and it was an incredibly interesting book. It was on J. Edgar Hoover, who just died. And so I got to watch Ladislaw Farrago dig up extraordinary material on J. Edgar Hoover right under my nose, and we were working on it when he died.
What about this book, though, the Martin Bormann and the Fourth Reich? The idea of a Fourth Reich, it almost sounds like a thriller rather than, you know, non-fiction book.
Well, Lotzi's a Hungarian, and he's looking, obviously, in his publisher. Being a publisher, I can tell you, we sometimes stretch a headline or a title. Fourth Reich is, I think, overdoing it. Basically, I think what Farrago believed and what I believe is that basically Bormann was not as much a Nazi in his operations in South America as he was one hell of a businessman with all kinds of fingers and all kinds of pies, as well as cooperating with various intelligence agencies.
Yeah, well, that shouldn't surprise us, because the Nazi Party was very, very close to big business, particularly the steel industry, etc., in Nazi Germany, wasn't it? It was actually funded largely through people like Krupps, the steel companies. So if you wanted a kind of nasty kind of business person, a Nazi.
Well, they did what they needed to do to get financed. They did a very good job of raising money from Germans. But if you get the big money to get over the hump after they were in power so they could stay in power, they had to turn the industrialists in Germany into picking up with the party, which they did, as you remember, through the Night of the Long Knives when they killed off the SA, which basically was competing with Hitler to take over the party and, in effect, to take over the German Wehrmacht and the army itself.
Yeah, the SR, I think, for people that don't know, particularly young people, this was a kind of group of street-fighting thugs, effectively, wasn't it?
Well, more than that, they were basically originally organized to take on the communist street-fighting thugs, who were outnumbered them hugely, and they slowly grew until they outnumbered the Red Front, and then they just kept growing. Interestingly enough, the guy who ran them had taken a couple of years off working to get the Bolivian army on its feet. And when I got to Bolivia, I found all kinds of Ernst Röhm memorabilia all over the place.
So anyway, Martin Bormann, what was his role in Nazi Germany? Because he was eventually a wanted war criminal sentenced to death in absentia at the Nuremberg trials. Who was this guy?
Well, Bormann was basically the guy who took Hess's place when Hess flew to England. Hess was the head of the Nazi Party, as well as being deputy Reichsführer. Bormann was not deputy Reichsführer, but he was head of party leader. And his job was to keep the various Gau. Germany was divided up into districts, each with a Gauleiter. And each Gauleiter, of course, was an empire builder on his own, competing with everybody else and keeping all these people from eating each other up and destroying the overall effort of the party, was the job of the party leader. Secondly, under Bormann, Bormann became the guy that you couldn't get to Hitler without going through Bormann. Hess wasn't interested in that role, but Bormann slowly but surely increased his power until he was controlling access to Hitler himself, and at a time which Hitler was getting more and more unstable, Bormann's grasp was very important.
So if he was controlling access to Hitler, then he becomes pretty much his private secretary. The job of the private secretary is quite often to constantly be kind of dictating what Hitler is saying. And that's quite a powerful role, because it gives them some sort of leeway for interpretation. And particularly when orders are being issued, you know, edicts are being issued.
Private secretary is a very British casting. In the States, we'd call him a chief of staff. And basically, he's the slot man. Everything comes over his desk. If you want the boss to sign it, you give it to Bormann. If you want the boss to take a look at it and approve it, you try and convince Bormann first, which in England, the private secretary is quite often in that role and in corporations as well as government positions.
So what about surviving the war? Did he survive the war, as Ladislaus Farrago said, do you think? And if so,
as I found, and to my surprise, a amazing investigation by a young German man, I think he was in his teens, got to Karl Wolff, who'd been the head of the SS in charge of Italy. He's a man actually who surrendered the Italian-German troops at the end of World War II before Nazi Germany surrendered. Quite a brilliant man. And Wolff tried to hook this kid up, you know, this is 20, 30 years ago, with Bormann, who was alive and in South America. And Karl Wolff was no idiot. He was one very canny guy. So if Karl Wolff says he's alive and well and operating in South America, I believe Karl Wolff.
But did you actually have any evidence? Because there's lots of people say that Bormann died literally the last few days of World War II in Berlin.
Well, we have to understand what that's all about. I think we've all gotten a little more cynical about our MI5, MI6, the FBI, the CIA. I think we all now understand when it's convenient for reasons of state, they will lie and lie and lie. Bormann's existence was inconvenient for the Federal Republic of Germany. It was certainly inconvenient for them at a time in which they were trying to reunify Germany, and there were many interim steps they had to take. And one of the steps they had to take was basically to make sure that important Nazis, that groups like the Republikaner Party or some of the neo-Nazi organizations couldn't coalesce around. For example, Hess, who was in Spandau prison, kept his distance from the neo-Nazis. But they were very worried that a Hess or a Bormann or anybody else who was alive, who was one of the major Nazis, might create a focus point that could create a competing power to the Free Democrats, the Social Democrats, and the Christian Democrats in the Federal Republic. So in my opinion, all the Germans did was to crank up a solution to a problem they hadn't solved. Where is his body? Okay, in 1972. It didn't persuade many people, except people who believe what a government intelligence agency tells you, when the intelligence agency obviously has an agenda.
Well, look, I mean, maybe the Germans weren't interested in finding Bormann, but surely the British, the Americans, particularly the Israelis, would be interested.
Well, I think Bormann, and Lotzi believe this, that Bormann was operating and trading information with Western intelligence services. It's one reason they didn't bother to go after him.
So if he did end up in South America, as you believe, how would he have got there?
Oh, there's a rat line through Italy. You could get out through, before the end of the war, it was possible to get out through Denmark and the Baltic Scandinavian access. There are a lot of ways out. And it's been documented by any number of people who are, God knows, no Nazi fans, how various Nazis got out. Some got out with I forget the name of this passport that you give displaced persons. They pretended to be DPs, Nanking passports. Others got out through the Catholic Church. I don't remember if Bormann was titularly Catholic or not, but the Catholic Church, a certain group within the Catholic Church was busy getting them out through Italy.
So how did Ladislaus Farrago track Bormann down? Did he actually manage to get photographs of him? Or was this just, was he close, but not quite close enough?
No, Lotzi wasn't into photographs. Lotzi was into contacts and working his way through well-connected people. How he would get the information he got was, he didn't discover, the Steele dossier, or he didn't do it through documentary stuff. He did it by basically like a monkey moving from vine to vine. He would move from contact to contact, and he struck gold with a top Argentine intelligence agent. And I think that's where the story really goes.
But you've got to have a photograph, surely, in order to prove the guy's theme. He's got to come out of a safe house or whatever it is from time to time. And there's that's surely the key bit of evidence that everyone wants, particularly a newspaper man.
Photographs are faked so often. I mean, they faked Oswald's photograph with the rifle for the Warren Commission. They can fake photographs all day long. I think the authenticity of having top intelligence people take you through files and contacts and hard information is a lot better than relying on any photograph.
So did he manage to track him down to a specific place, or did he have a whole series of places in South America, and which countries?
Well, he worked at it for quite a while. I didn't really think he'd ever get anywhere. But you've got to remember how really fine a journalist he was. He was two things, and it gets a little confusing sometimes. He was a Hungarian, and hence one of the world's best promoters. But he was also a very fine journalist. People forget that before the Nazis came to power in the 1920s, Farrago was the New York Times correspondent in Berlin right up to the Nuremberg laws in 1936. So he was there for the whole rise of the Nazi Party for the New York Times. There are not a lot of correspondents that spend almost 10 years. So he was highly valued. Then he went on for the AP, and he covered the Ethiopian War and brought out a lot of the horror stories that we now think of as just part of the history. But Lotzi got the information on the poison gas and a lot of the other things that are outrageous about the Ethiopian War. He then, in World War II, he came to the States. He became an American citizen. He worked for Naval Intelligence. We're talking about somebody with extraordinary abilities. He knew intelligence from the inside, as well as how to get information, how to use contacts as a first-rate journalist, and to do so in totalitarian regimes in places where it wasn't easy. So he had, if anybody had the skill set to do what he did, it was Farrago.
So whereabouts in South America was Borman? Was he in one particular spot, or was he on a border? I mean, that's one obvious thing. So you can run either way, can't you?
Well, that's an interesting story. I was sent to La Paz, Bolivia in 1968 to try and get the Che Guevara diaries. Che had just been killed. And every top news organization in the world, from Perry Match to the London Times, were all in La Paz trying to get these documents. And I was staying with the CIA station chief who ran a hotel called the Creon Hotel in La Paz, because I figured I'd stay alive a little longer if I stayed in his hotel. This was a nasty business. And there were still guerrillas around who didn't really want Westerners getting their hands on Che's material. One of the things this guy did, his name was Jim Cagles, wonderful guy. He took me to the German club in La Paz, and he proceeded to point out all the Nazis who were there. It was a great club. The food was terrific. And the Germans, who had been a presence in Bolivia for a long time, had Bolivian beer was absolutely superb. They had great beer. And so I got a sense for the milieu. And, you know, one thinks of Paraguay and Argentina as Nazi places to reside. I never thought of Bolivia, but when he showed me the number of people in the room, well, Lotzi finally ran down Borman, who was very, very sick, and I think senile, I can't recall, in some nunnery stuck out in the wilds of Bolivia. So there he was. He finally ran him down. He couldn't talk to him. He couldn't get anything out of him. But he got him and proved he was, in my opinion, he proved that Borman had lived and, in fact, got to South America.
Okay, so what was Borman up to over there? Or what had he been up to?
Well, he seems to have played a very strong hand, from what I've learned from my contacts, and not so much from Lotzi. He was basically taking get, he was like a working like an investment banker. He was directing other people's funds, who were German funds that were already overseas. And there are all kinds of arguments about how much the Nazis got out of Germany before they went and where the money went. But I suspect the money was everywhere from Switzerland to the usual places. And Bormann was in a position to make investments. So he proceeded to put Germans together and, in effect, create interlocking directorships and corporate interests that created quite a powerful business empire. And he was having a ball, making a lot of money, staying out of sight, and doing this. So that's not exactly a Fourth Reich.
Well, no, as I was going to say, is in a way, it sounds to me as if, you know, whilst there were people that were great believers in the Nazi ideals, you know, German nationalism, you know, this kind of fake version of German history, with the Teutonic Knights and all this stuff. But for Bormann, it seems that it was really more of a kind of organized crime operation, a front, really, for organized crime.
I think that's a fair comment.
So, was he able to travel, Bormann, before this period, you know, in the 20 years after World War II, to Europe and North America?
I don't know whether he came to North America or not. My guess, I mean, look, they all traveled. Mengele traveled back and forth to Germany. His family was very wealthy. They were the international harvester or great agricultural implements organization. What do you have in England that does that, makes tractors and things? So they were very, very wealthy. And Mengele would go back and forth all kinds of times. Bormann wouldn't probably be going to Germany, but he might go to Switzerland. He might go to other banking centers, might have gone to London. But I don't think that, I think he traveled intelligently. And my guess is he was very skillful at working bureaucracies, and he would get a high sign from somebody saying, come right ahead, we won't bother you, and he'd do it.
Well, Stuart Stephen was the son of Jewish emigre parents. So they came over right at the very start of World War II to Bristol in the UK, mm-hmm. and he worked for a while on our big regional paper, the Western Daily Press. Then he went up to the Daily Express and eventually became foreign editor there. Now, he picked up on Ladislas Ferrago's story and ran it as a front-page lead, didn't he, back in 1972. Yeah. So Bormann's discovery in 72, why was this story so quickly withdrawn? Because, as I understand it, the Stuart Stephen was ticked off over publishing this.
Well, you could turn the question around. You could say, why did the German intelligence services suddenly find Bormann's body in 1972?
So was that quite quickly after the Daily Express headline?
You bet. They put that fire out as fast as they could.
I mean, were we talking about within days or weeks or what?
I don't remember what the timing is. As they say, you could look it up. But the point being that Ferrago's investigations were being watched by every intelligence agency in the world. You used to joke about it. He'd say that, I wonder how many people are listening to my phone tonight. And so basically everybody knew what he was doing. And so heading him off at the pass, nobody wanted to do that more than the Germans. And by golly, if they didn't go and find the body right there by the old bridge, right where the witness Axmann said he'd seen it.
Do we know where and when Bormann died?
I don't, and I assumed at the nunnery up there in the mountains in Bolivia. He was pretty far gone.
So I'm wondering, you know, if the Germans found the body, what evidence did they have that this was really Bormann and that Ladislas and Stuart Stephen had got it all wrong?
Well, they had, as you may remember, they had DNA that they compared with a relative from the body they found, and they also had dental evidence. Intelligence services always have dental evidence. It's the damnedest thing. It's the one thing. They always can find the dental records. Isn't that something? So they found Bormann's dental records. The story I heard in Argentina was that they went to Bormann's tomb and they cut his head off and took it to Germany and left the rest of the body in the tomb. So the head provides the dental evidence and it provides the DNA. Very convenient. Doesn't take a big package.
Well, I understand that it had this skull had red clay on it, which you don't find in Berlin. You only find it in Paraguay, wherever this skull came from. Fascinating, you know, this forensic evidence, which it doesn't actually add up. It does make you wonder whether it's a cover up of some sort. But this guy Bormann, do we know how much wealth he controlled? At the end of the war, he was the holder of the bank accounts, mostly in Switzerland, of much of the wealth that had been looted from the whole of Europe during World War II.
Well, we can sit and imagine, but I don't think anybody's got a fix on it, because the Swiss aren't going to tell anybody, right? So since the Swiss aren't going to tell, people can sit around and count fingers and toes all they want to. We haven't the least idea. And the real question is, there seems to have been a lot of traffic back and forth to South America with submarines. How much gold did they take over on those trips? They weren't all with people on board, because you couldn't possibly leave Nazi Germany until you got the high sign or somebody would put a bullet through your head. So they were transporting something back and forth to Argentina. But I don't think there's any way of knowing. We know. You could look at what was missing, because the Nazis did the same thing the Americans did in World War II. We took everybody's gold reserves and put them in Fort Knox. And the Nazis took Austria's, Hungary's, every country they conquered, gold reserves, and put them in the bank. So you can figure out, and this is really would be an interesting book, somebody figuring out what happened to the money. Add it all up, see how much was recovered, a lot was, and how much is missing.
Now, the Mossad, the Israeli Secret Service, went for Eichmann, didn't they, in the 1960s?
Yeah.
And yet, by looking at Bormann and his role in the edicts that he issued to do with the Final Solution, he was also the sort of person you would imagine that the Mossad would be on the top of their list.
Well, Eichmann was a paper shuffler. I mean, if he wasn't directly involved in the Final Solution, because Hitler wasn't directly involved in the Final Solution. It was basically an SS operation, and he was a paper shuffler in the Reichskanzlerei. And since Hitler wasn't really getting his hands dirty with it, you can certainly say that Bormann was a war criminal, because he was part of a criminal operation. And the Holocaust was an aspect of the criminal operation. But operationally, Mengele was up to his neck in stuff with the Holocaust, and Bormann wasn't. So if I were an Israeli Mossad agent, I had two reasons to go after Eichmann. One is he totally became so arrogant, he used his own name, and everybody knew who he was. And basically, he was easy to snatch. And finally, he'd put the fear of the Lord into everybody else. So he was a terrific catch for them. Bormann wasn't going to be that easy.
It almost sounds like you're saying that Eichmann was a bit of a scapegoat, actually.
Well, I think one wants to make a point. If I were an Israeli, I would want to find the nastiest butcher I could find and make a public example of him to the Palestinians, the Egyptians, the Syrians, the Iranians, etc., that this is what we do if you screw around with us, and good for them.
Yeah, but Thomas, is there really any point in pursuing this story today? And if so, why?
I think there's a point in pursuing any number of stories whereby we find the intelligence agencies and corporations of the world uniting with bad guys while pretending to be virtuous. I don't mind their saying we're all whores and this guy is convenient to us and that's why we didn't pull him in, whatever they want to do. But the fact that they deny it and they have these huge networks all working together is, I think, obscene.
What about the organized crime aspect, though? I mean, surely, if this guy's been able to operate an ex-Nazi, condemned to death, able to operate in organised crime, it does make you wonder the extent of organised crime today and, you know, how on earth we can deal with ordinary organised criminals when somebody so important as this that you would have hoped they would have been pursued just simply wasn't.
Well, he's not an organised criminal. He's a civil criminal, one. And two, he's operating as a corporate white-collar criminal, not running around shooting people up with Uzis. And so he's not the kind of person who draws a lot of attention to his operations.
I wonder just that finally if there's anything you'd like to add.
I just think that basically the reason to chase after these guys till the last dog dies is to expose the degree of complicity with the West, which many of them have had for many, many years. We know about Operation Paperclip and getting Nazi scientists out and the competition between the East and the West to get their scientists and forget whatever they might have done in Germany. But basically, this goes beyond that. These are high state policy exercises, and we need to know a lot more about what has been going on.
Okay, so that's Thomas Lipscomb there. A couple of things probably to say about that, Martin. He talks a lot about Bolivia there. And isn't it interesting how the Bolivian president, even though he won the election, Evo Morales, has been chased out of the country? That's still apparently, you haven't got a democratic president. He's democratically elected, but there's demonstrations in the streets, and the democratically elected president is chased out of the country. The latest story I've seen about that whole episode is March this year, where the United States University Department, which has been looking into Morales is being chased out of Bolivia, is saying that there was no evidence of fraud in the Morales poll. So everything's still hot in Bolivia.
Well, and there's a big, strong Croatian connection as well. The Ustasha, who were the fascists in Croatia, a lot of them ended up in Bolivia. And, of course, Klaus Barbie famously went to Bolivia, and he was the butcher of Lyon. And he basically trained the Bolivian army after Ernst Röhm, because Ernst Röhm went there in the 30s. We're talking about the 1960s. And Bolivia has got a very strong Nazi fascist history, and of course it's all embedded with the CIA to prevent the Bolivians having a country that they can call their own.
Interesting as well that he was apparently hiding in a monastery, or apparently a convent or a nunnery, because Martin Bormann's son is Martin Bormann Jr. is his name. He's been facing accusations of sexual assault because he became a priest. So one does wonder if some of the most evil people in the world choose these roles of priests as a kind of cover for their activities.
Well, as I say, I mentioned the Ustasha earlier. They were Catholics. And a lot of them were protected by the Catholic Church at the end of the war, and they're given Vatican passports to get them to Latin America, which is largely Catholic. So the current regime in Bolivia has got lots of links with those kind of people.
Well, I await with some enthusiasm, actually, Tom Lipscomb's books coming out on the flight of Rudolf Hess, and also of the JFK assassination, Martin. So I understand he believes that the Chicago Mafia hitman James Files was the one who actually killed John F. Kennedy, which is exactly the sort of thing that we've been. So it's nice to know that we've got a kind of equivalent, even though he's a much more, sort of highbrow guy working for, in the past, for a big newspaper, Tom Lipscomb. So, time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Irish Republican Labour activist, who you just heard there as well, Martin Summers. Download our MP3s, and you can listen in the car or anywhere you like. Also, we'll be on YouTube too, on the Public Inquiry channel. You'll find this show's podcast, story links and comment page, and our contact details at thisweek, oneword.org www.tomlipscomb.co.uk. And thank you very much for one of our listeners, I can't remember who it was now, who suggested I track down Tom Lipscomb about 2 months ago, I think. I got a message saying you should chat to this guy, and there you go, there he was. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Sunday evenings at 7 with Danny Loch, well worth a listen. BCFM boss Pat Hart did say our sister show Dialect would be on BCFM every Monday at 10 p.m. In a text message to me. So far, it just hasn't appeared. We'll be back on FM soon when other shows resume, hopefully on the week of the 20th of June. That's next week. Pat Hart willing, our managing editor. Do please join us for the Politics Show live stream at the old time of 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.